Welcome to the Bulgarian History Podcast, episode 204, The Bulgarian Summer. First, I want to thank our newest patrons, Victor Ponfol, I hope I'm saying your name right, Jim Bird, Ivo Albrecht, and a big thanks to Andre von Menz and Daniel McClelland for their generous donations. Huge thank you to all of you for supporting the show. And a quick note for those who are interested, listener Alexander Panoff asked me about getting the podcast on YouTube Music. I know a lot of people use YouTube Music to listen to podcasts. And after a bunch of time, I found out that YouTube won't let me do this because of vague reasons. Anyone who's dealt with like Google Terms of Service or, you know, tried to, yeah, just Google can be very, very opaque about this. And it's hard to figure out why you can't do certain things. But I'm going to check it out later in the system. But in the meantime, Alexander found out that you can export podcasts from Google Podcasts to YouTube Music. If you want to use YouTube Music for that, that's a way you can do it. Anyways. Enough about Google stuff, figuring all that out. Let's get into the episode. Now, last time, we covered late 1914 leading into the spring of 1915 as the Entente and the Central Powers each vied to convince Bulgaria to join their side, or in the case of the Entente, at least stay neutral. Meanwhile, Austria-Hungary struggled against Serbia, mounting no less than 3 failed invasions of the country. However, Serbia was still in bad shape, facing shortages of ammunition and equipment while being hampered by Vemuro attacks in Macedonia, even mounting a large-scale revolt, though that was quickly crushed. The Ottomans also entered the war on the side of the Central Powers. Now, all these events, alongside the wars devolving into a stalemate, increased the value of Bulgarian intervention. But early 1915 saw an attack on the Dardanelles nearly convince Bulgaria to give up on joining the Central Powers, until the loss of 3 Entente battleships in the Straits showed that knocking the Ottomans out of the war was going to be a little harder than had been anticipated. We finished off in April of 1915 with the assassination of Jan Sandanski, further weakening his faction of the Macedonian Revolutionary Movement, and that's where we are. So, today's episode actually begins a few days before that assassination on April 10th, when the Ottoman Empire begins deporting Armenian intellectuals to detention centers near Ankara. The goal was to incapacitate the empire's Armenian community by swiftly taking out their leaders. Many of these leaders were ultimately killed, though several survived because they were Bulgarian citizens, a reminder that Bulgaria has had a small Armenian community for centuries and still has one today. There are a few Armenian restaurants and things in Sofia. There's a few Armenian churches around the country. But yeah, it's a minority that's so tiny it's rarely acknowledged or talked about. But here is a reminder, you know, many of Armenian leaders that were kind of facing this kind of persecution in the Ottoman Empire were Bulgarian citizens. But all that to say, these events in April 1915 are commonly viewed as the beginning of the Armenian genocide. Now, literally the day after that began, Entente troops began landing at the beaches of Gallipoli. Recall, as I just mentioned, a few months earlier, British and French warships had attempted to just sail straight through the Dardanelles to attack Constantinople directly, but the loss of 3 warships forced them to turn back and reevaluate their strategy. In short, they determined that landing troops was necessary to take out the coastal gun batteries so that they could then sail a fleet to the Ottoman capital and knock them out of the war. So, the reality was, yeah, Constantinople would be helpless to these warships. Anyone who's been to Istanbul could see that, yes, if you had a warship with some big guns in the strait, in the water there, you could just destroy any part of the city you wanted at will. Now, the European and Asian ports, this would also mean that the European and the Asian parts of the Ottoman Empire would be cut off from one another, and it would be a lot easier to get supplies to Russia through the straits. So there were a lot of benefits of doing this. So most assumed that these landings would, as they assumed the warships would, just knock the Ottomans out fairly quickly. But instead, the soldiers were quickly bogged down into a stalemate as Australian and New Zealand soldiers struggled to advance beyond the landing beaches. But April 1915 was just getting started because the day after the Gallipoli landings, which is day by day here, Italy signed the Treaty of London, formally joining the Entente. This was a big deal because before the war, Italy had been in a defensive alliance with Germany and Austria-Hungary. However, because those two countries had been the ones who began the war by attacking Serbia, Italy had no treaty obligation to get involved. And in any case, the, you know, Austro-Hungarians in particular had really kind of ignored and neglected what they had promised to do under this treaty. So yes, Italy was technically connected to the Central Powers, but it was feeling very kind of ignored by them and, you know, wasn't exactly feeling it had much obligations to their side. So, ironically, Italy's joining the war was actually deeply entwined with Bulgaria. Despite the two having no real overlap in the territory they desired, it again came down to Serbia. Italy wanted the Dalmatian coast of Austria-Hungary to be taken away from them. They wanted to really dominate the Adriatic Sea. But like with Albania, that would block Serbia from gaining sea access. So the Entente powers could ask Serbia to give up sea access, or they could hand Vardar Macedonia over to Bulgaria, but they couldn't ask Serbia for both. So because Italy was now on the side of the Entente powers, there was essentially no chance, well, seemingly no chance, that the Entente powers could allow or promise Serbia access to the sea, which made what was already very unlikely, Serbia handing over Macedonia, even less likely. So, ironically, Italy joining the Entente powers, without a doubt, strengthened the Entente. But it also meant that the Entente was an even less appealing option for Bulgaria, because the odds that Bulgaria could get the territory it wanted from the Entente decreased even further to, you know, you could say less than zero. So essentially, just as had happened in the Balkan Wars, the fact that the great powers wanted Adriatic territories that Serbia wanted pushed them to hand over Macedonia as a concession prize, to the detriment of hundreds of thousands of Bulgarians living there. Though it is worth noting that Winston Churchill disagreed with all of this, writing to the British Prime Minister, quote, "I am all for playing the right game to get Bulgaria. She is the real prize, and it is only if and when we know she will not come that we should consider Greek and Serbian interests," end quote. So, interestingly enough, Churchill was more interested and saw the value of Bulgaria because, well, spoiler alert for those of you familiar with the First World War, yeah, Italy was, you know, a reasonably large power, but it didn't contribute much to the war. It won't really move the needle, whereas Bulgaria joining the war will. So Churchill could see that. But another question. Why did Italy wait so long? Now, for one, like Bulgaria, the Italians knew that the longer the war dragged on in stalemate, the more valuable their help would become, and so the more they could ask for. But they also believed that Bulgaria was going to join the Entente soon, virtually ensuring an Entente victory in the Balkans. They also believed that the participation of Italian troops in taking Constantinople would help alleviate Russian fears that the city had been promised to the Tsar, that the Bulgarians or the Greeks might just take it for themselves anyways. So this really kind of upset the balance, and you can see Italians saw that this was really the right moment for them to jump in order to kind of get ahead of some of these potential problems for them. But at the end of the day, Italy's joining the war created deep contradictions in the Entente alliance. Recall that Serbia had recently issued the Niš Declaration, stating their intention to unite the Serbs, Croats, and Slovenes in a single state. Yet at the same time, Serbia's allies were promising territories where Slovats and Croats and Slovenes lived to Italy. But, you know, there were a lot of contradictions, and those, you know, could be handled at the end of the war. So for now, the Entente powers are very willing to promise contradictory things, though granted they haven't promised this to Serbia, they just understand that's what Serbia has declared it wants. All that matters is getting another ally, and they can figure out the rest later. Still, when the terms of Italy's entry into the war became known, it enraged supporters of a greater Serbian South Slav state. The Serbian Prime Minister, in particular, was furious that both that Serbia had not been consulted and that these terms violated the principles of self-determination. But in any case, just under a month later, in early May, Italy declared war on the Central Powers and launched an offensive against the Austrians in the Alps on their mutual border. Now, it's at this point that we enter a period known as the Bulgarian Summer. The summer of 1915, when the Entente and the Central Powers both begin to really ramp up their efforts to convince Bulgaria to join their side. But while the Entente considered Bulgaria valuable, the Central Powers saw it as essential, with the German Chief of Staff von Falkenhayn saying, quote, "It is most important that we gain Bulgaria quickly and at any price, because the key to the entire situation in Eastern Europe lies in Sofia," end quote. It's a bit ironic, right? We've seen, you know, you follow this podcast, you know, time and time again, Bulgaria's really been, you could say, cursed by geography. Its position in the middle of the Balkans has created just innumerable problems and challenges for the country in terms of defending its borders and building strong alliances and things. But it's a bit ironic. Here in the First World War, now that position is in part what makes Bulgaria just incredibly valuable. Now, this Bulgarian summer really kicked off when in mid-May, the Entente presented an offer. Bulgaria would regain the portion of eastern Thrace it had lost to the Ottomans in the Second Balkan War, would obtain the undisputed zone of Vardar Macedonia, which Serbia had initially promised to Bulgaria in their original alliance, and they would receive southern Dobruja back from Romania, as well as Kavala from Greece. In return, they would simply need to help defend Serbia and help quickly knock the Ottomans out of the war by attacking towards Constantinople. Ironically, this would have meant retaking all the Thracian forts the Bulgarians had just fought so hard to take less than 3 years earlier and had now been given back to the Ottomans. However, Bulgaria knew that the Entente could not guarantee almost any of this. Romania and Greece were both neutral, so how the Entente could guarantee those territories went to Bulgaria was unknown. Serbia, as you know, has said absolutely categorically no to giving any bit of Macedonia over to Bulgaria. So, yeah, I mean, the offer of that portion of Macedonia going to Bulgaria was, in any case, conditional on Serbia's acceptance, which was never going to happen. Now, it was a bit ironic because Serbia had, as we know, insisted on getting all of Macedonia in part to compensate them from not getting access to the sea. But actually, at this moment in mid-1915, Serbia was basically invading Albania, managing around this time to take Tirana and Elbasan. So, although, you know, there's no guarantee they would get to keep any of this, Serbia was actually, you know, nearly reaching the Adriatic Sea at this very moment. So, okay, the Entente have put forward a, you know, seemingly generous offer on paper, but an offer that, you know, is completely devoid from reality. But when an offer came from the Central Powers a few weeks later, it sounded, you could say, a lot more compelling. They offered Bulgaria all of Vardar Macedonia, not just the undisputed portion from that 1912 treaty with Serbia, the Morava region of Serbia, alongside support in taking Kavala and southern Dobruja if Greece or Romania got involved, so a lot more specific there. In exchange, all Bulgaria would have to do was attack Serbia, who they already hated, wanted revenge on, and who, let's be real, Serbia was not going to be able to put up a fight against both Austria-Hungary to the north and Bulgaria to the east. So attacking them didn't seem like it would be too difficult a challenge. As June turned into July, the war did begin to shift. While back in May, Bulgaria was indeed nearly ready to join the Entente. The Russians had taken the vital Austro-Hungarian fortress of Przemysl. Minor side note, just a funny little story. I once ate these little small fried dough balls called buktichki at a very cute cafe in Veliko Tarnovo that had a bunch of pink and things, and the kind of fake newspaper wrapping that they were served in contained a story about the siege of Przemysl, which I just found hilarious It's a weird juxtaposition. I'll post a photo on the blog post of this episode if I remember, but yeah, minor random story about the siege of Przemysl. Anyways, so back in May, you know, the Russians had taken Przemysl. The Serbs were still successfully beating back the Austrians. The Italians had just joined the war, and the landings at Gallipoli looked like they might indeed knock the Ottomans out of the war. So back in May, the Entente was riding high. It was looking like an Entente victory could be imminent. But now, just a few months later in July, it was clear that the Italian attack on the Austrians was a total failure. The terms of the Italians joining made Serbia even more determined to hold Macedonia. The Gallipoli landings were a disaster. Przemysl, along with most of Poland, had been retaken from Russia, resulting in the Russians losing 750,000 men and a territory greater than the size of France. And in general, now the Central Powers looked like they might ultimately come out on top. In particular, the fact that the Entente was failing so badly against the Ottomans, which Bulgaria had defeated so decisively 2.5 years earlier, made a strong impression on everyone, and really led a lot of observers to have even greater faith in the strength and the quality of Bulgaria's armies. Because it was easy back during the Balkan Wars to say, okay, yeah, the Bulgarians wiped the floor with the Ottomans, but, you know, it's the Ottomans as a sick man of Europe. Their armies are in terrible shape. Makes sense. But now, watching the, you know, British-led Australian-New Zealand force struggle so much against the Ottomans, it really made it look like the Bulgarians were on par with or even superior to those kind of great power-led forces. Now, on the 21st of July, the Entente sent another note to the government in Sofia, reiterating its previous offer in May, creating frustration in the government that the Entente wasn't willing to do more to win Bulgaria as an ally. They were just going to make an entirely unrealistic offer and then just say, hey, do you remember that offer we made? Have you thought about it? Maybe you still want to say yes? Even Churchill was at this point deeply annoyed and frustrated at what he saw as a lack of urgency and focus on gaining Bulgaria's friendship, writing to the UK Foreign Office that, quote, for the present, we are in the Bulgarian camp. Let us stay there. She is worth all the rest put together, and she would bring all the rest in too, end quote. So, within the Entente powers, some see Bulgaria as vital, that the Entente should do pretty much anything they can to win Bulgaria as an ally, but those actually in charge of doing so are clearly not too concerned about it, again, making unrealistic offers and then not being willing to up the ante or really get into some back and forth to negotiate to figure out, okay, what would it require? What would Bulgaria need? Of course, in all of this, Serbia remained a constant problem, thwarting any attempts to offer Bulgaria enough territory to bring her into the war. The British Foreign Secretary wrote of the situation in his memoir, writing, quote, never were dice so heavily loaded against anything as against Allied diplomacy in 1915. Serbia was under obligation to the Allies for help given. Her only hope for survival lay in an Allied victory. In that event, Serbia would not only survive intact, but would get large acquisitions of Slav territory at present held by Austria. These gains would have been made possible only by the efforts and sacrifices and victory of the Allies. We were therefore entitled to press Serbia to make concessions to Bulgaria that were essential to the safety of Serbia and the common cause. Serbia was quite intractable. In vain, I pointed out that France, Britain, and Russia had no troops to spare and could send none to help Serbia. That an attack by Bulgaria must be fatal to her. That if she would only concede what was necessary to secure Bulgaria's friendship, there was every prospect of a victory in which Serbia would gain far more than she was now being asked to concede. It was all in vain. The Serbian minister closed on the conversation with me by saying that they would rather all die than let Bulgaria have Monastir. A preference for death put an end to all argument, and I became respectfully silent. So that gives you an idea of what trying to negotiate with Serbia is like for these great power foreign ministers and things. Serbia is absolutely intractable about Macedonia. It's a bit ironic, though, hearing them kind of protest the Italian entry to the war and the prospect of Italy gaining Slav territories in the Adriatic because this violates the prospect of self-determination, while they insist on holding on to a territory that, if offered self-determination, would almost certainly side with Bulgaria, Macedonia. So, you know, it's typical for diplomacy of this era, but it's still a little eye-rolling to see the hypocrisy in some of these areas. Now, interestingly, many assume that Ferdinand's favoring of the Central Powers was a given. After all, he was from Austria, his family had Austrian and German roots, but remember, he was also the grandson of the last king of France. His family ties connected him to both sides of the conflict, and his approach was directed by realism, as he was determined to get the best outcome for Bulgaria. He was also keenly aware of how much his own personal popularity had taken a hit as a result of the Second Balkan War, and that another such disaster could easily mean losing his throne or his life. Now, ironically, the French government actually sent one of Ferdinand's relatives from the former French royal family. Remember, France is a republic at this time, but there's still some descendants of the old royals. Anyway, so they sent one of these royals to Sofia in early 1915 to try to convince the Tsar that his connection to France should ensure his allegiance with them. But this did little more than annoy and aggravate Ferdinand, who later noted that, quote, "The France of my ancestors calls me a traitor. She insists that, as a grandson of Louis-Philippe, I ought not to have fought against her. This I find somewhat amusing, since France herself gave Louis-Philippe this conge and would have none of him or his family." End quote. Now, I had to look up the word conge. It means an unceremonious dismissal or rejection of someone. So it is understandable, right, that France, you know, kicked out or murdered all of the royals and, you know, really sort of kicked out the idea of monarchy, but then has the gall to go to Ferdinand and say, "Oh, but you're the descendant of the monarchy, and so thus, how could you ever turn against us?" All the while, France is not really willing, seemingly, to go to bat to actually try to win over Ferdinand, right? It's, you know, someone saying, like, "Yeah, we're not going to pay you for this, but, like, we think that you should do this work anyways out of a sense of obligation to us, even though we haven't really been nice to you about it." It's not exactly a strong argument. I mean, Ferdinand rightfully pointed out how absurd it was to insist that the Tsar of Bulgaria remain loyal to France for family reasons, noting that the same apparently did not apply to the mostly German royal families of the UK or Russia. Now, granted, for Tsar Ferdinand, revenge was also a not insignificant motivating factor. On the eve of war, he is said to have reported that the destruction of Serbia was the great purpose of his life. Crampton also makes an interesting point that while the Entente mostly worked to build support amongst opposition politicians, granted they were the ones most inclined to support the Entente anyways, the Central Powers, by contrast, lobbied Ferdinand and those around him directly. And as we know, Ferdinand had an immense amount of personal power and control in Bulgaria, and in reality, his opinion mattered far more than any political leader, including the Prime Minister. Because as we've seen time and time again, if Ferdinand doesn't like the government, if he doesn't like the Prime Minister, he will just dismiss them and essentially orchestrate someone else to come to power. He's done so over and over, he's done so fairly easily. So, yeah, trying to kind of turn those opposition, let alone not even the Prime Minister in charge, but the opposition to your side was really just not a smart strategy by the Entente. Now, as a quick side note, in Easter 1915, Ferdinand's excommunication from the Catholic Church was finally rescinded after 19 years. Remember, 19 years before this, when then Prince Ferdinand had allowed his son and heir, Boris, to become Orthodox because it was required in the Constitution, and the Catholic Church freaked out. But now, apparently, he's finally reconciled with the Catholic Church. Anyways, July of 1915 also saw former Prime Minister Geshoff give an interview to a French newspaper in which he expressed both his fear that Bulgaria joining the Central Powers would prove disastrous, and his deep frustrations with the Entente, who were, quote, "failing to appreciate the significance of Bulgarian intervention in the war and persisting in their preference for Serbia and Greece," end quote. Soon, Gashof and 109 other prominent citizens signed a letter urging Ferdinand to sign with the Entente. Indeed, the opposition leaders, minus the narrow socialists, ultimately created a parliamentary group called the United Bloc and demanded at least an open debate on whether Bulgaria should join the war. But Prime Minister Radoslavov refused. By this point, it was increasingly clear that the Entente was losing the battle for influence in Bulgaria, leading the Entente to consider trying other methods. As a result, beginning in July, an influence scandal began to develop. It began with Fernand de Croisiré, I hope I'm saying that right, my French is a little rusty, an assistant to the main representative of French holders of Bulgarian bonds. He had been living in Sofia for more than a decade and was pretty well connected there. So in July, British and French banks gave de Croisiré the equivalent of 20 million leva to buy the entire Bulgarian wheat harvest so it could be sent as food aid to Russia. To do this, he worked with Nikola Gennadyev, the foreign minister and the head of the National Liberal Party, one of the members of the current ruling coalition. Gennadyev then worked with members of his party as well as several members of the Agrarian Party to make the actual purchases of wheat. These men were then given large advances of money in excess of what was needed to actually buy the crops, and money was then also paid to members of the Bulgarian Commercial Bank to facilitate all the transactions. Now, if you're wondering where all this is going, it ultimately turned out that all this was basically a cover and a way for this guy and the kind of the British and French bond associations of banks and things to pay off politicians to support the Entente under the guise of buying all this wheat. Well, at least that was the accusation. A military court later found many involved guilty, but there's also evidence that many of the agrarian members involved were kind of unaware of what they were doing other than selling grain at high wartime prices to help the Bulgarian peasants. So yeah, certainly some people involved in this knew that this was a kind of corruption scheme and it was trying to buy their influence. But yeah, the fact, you know, Bell in his book points out that the Agrarian Party never changed its opposition to joining the war on either side as proof that there wasn't this corrupt influence, because the agrarian politicians that did receive this money never changed anything. There was never the end part of the quid pro quo. And it's pretty understandable to assume, okay, there's a war, food prices are up, and so someone wants to buy food at inflated prices. That's not a crazy situation that you would say, ah, clearly something is up here. So yeah, with all that said, this attempt to build support for the Entente, in any case, just totally failed. And in the meantime, Bulgaria was still drawing ever closer to the Central Powers. In late August, Bulgaria and the Ottomans signed a new protocol to clarify their new border. The deal was quite generous for Bulgaria, as it gained over 2,500 square kilometers of territory. In particular, Bulgaria gained both banks of the Maritsa River and the territory containing a railway that would lead to its new port on the Aegean, making it far easier for Bulgaria to use both to facilitate trade and movement. But as you might have guessed, this agreement wasn't signed in isolation. At the same time, Bulgaria signed a series of secret treaties with Germany to basically officially join the Central Powers. The deal lined up with what the Central Powers had previously offered: all of Serbian-controlled Vardar Macedonia, as well as a large portion of Serbian territory. And in addition, if Romania joined the war on the side of the Entente, Bulgaria was promised southern Dobruja and a portion of northern Dobruja. And if Greece joined, Bulgaria would receive the eastern portion of the Aegean Macedonia, including Kavala, but not including Thessaloniki. So almost all of what Bulgaria wanted. Bulgaria was also offered a loan of 200 million francs, along with a promise of further financing if it was needed. In return, Bulgaria promised to attack Serbia within 30 days. Remember, these treaties were secret, so the idea was to ensure that this attack came as a surprise. And ironically, a week after this, the Entente, who was unaware that Bulgaria had already made a decision, actually came back with a new offer, saying that Bulgaria will get the undisputed zone of Vardar Macedonia for not joining the war. But again, there was no way they could force Serbia to do that, and it was clear to everyone that Serbia was dead set against it. And in any case, it was far too late by this point. August 1915 was turning into September, and with it, the Bulgarian summer was ending. The courtiers had all made their offers to Bulgaria, and the debutante at this bloody European ball had made her choice. Even with hindsight, it's kind of difficult to imagine any other outcome. Macedonia remained the great tragic hope in the Bulgarian psyche, and only the Central Powers could realistically offer it. So now, almost exactly 3 years after Bulgaria entered this new bloody era by joining the First Balkan War, and almost exactly 2 years since the country went through its first national catastrophe, Bulgaria is set to enter its third war in as many years. The country is exhausted, but it is eager for revenge. Next time, we'll look at the rapid series of changes that will come with Bulgaria's mobilization and entry into the war, as well as the early military events that will come as fighting begins. As always, you won't want to miss it. This episode was written and produced by me, Eric Halsey. The theme music was written and performed by the talented Teddy Raven. As always, you can check out the kind of blog post for this linked in the episode description for a lot more information. There's also a link to the Patreon there. And I will catch you in the next one.